It can be in private language, you don't want to, that's fine. Okay, so the midterm is ready. You can pick it up at the end of the class. I thought you should have candy in the beginning so that you can pay attention, and then returned exams at the end so that you can miss the next class instead of mine. I sent the statistics on the marks, etc. If you have questions, if you have questions on the grading, talk to me. I should be posting the solution soon. And then if you have done the thing again at home, then that should reach you eventually. This one had to be done so that beforehand, I guess, how you did in the exam. Hopefully the other ones also should be done early enough, get it to you. The other thing is the makeup class. We're going to have it on next Friday, not this Friday, but next Friday. The basic idea is that the Monday after that, there's no class. Okay, it's a holiday. It's the Veterans Day holiday. So even if you wind up missing Friday's class, you will be able to make up by looking at the lecture, etc., by Wednesday, so that there won't be any continuity lost. So I thought that's the best opportunity we have. So it would be, as I said earlier, it'll be essentially the same time. I'll try to have it around 10:40, basically 10:40 to 11:55 time frame. And I'll also try to see if I can get this room. If not, I'll let you know which room. Okay? So just so that you can go ahead and make your plans. Any other questions?
If we don't have class on Monday, then when is the project due for the next?
The class, not next Monday. Monday after that is what is the holiday. Next Monday and Wednesday we will be meeting as before. But the Monday after that, November 12th, is the Veterans Day holiday observance, because November 11th is actually a holiday, is a Sunday. Okay? Any other questions? Okay. So what I'm planning to do today is continue with the model theoretic and proof theoretic inference in first order logic. We looked at, I assume that you all read the inference chapter, the specific sections that I asked you to look at. So we started talking about this last time, and we pointed out that there is the Tarskian interpretations, but obviously Tarskian interpretations are infinite in number for propositional as well as first order logic. Okay, because you can decide to identify any propositional symbol with any true or false statement in the world. And similarly, in first order logic, any object in the first order logic, any constant can be associated with any real world object, any function can be associated with any functional relationship, any predicate can be associated with any predicate relationship, any relation. Okay. So because you have all these possibilities, there are many, many Tarskian interpretations. And so normally, the idea is to try and do to first order logic what we did for propositional logic, which is think in terms of equivalent interpretation. Okay. So the example is the following. So in fact, since you understand it already in the propositional logic, one way of thinking about it is, can I do inference in first order logic by converting it into propositional logic? Okay, it more or less works. For example, suppose I have a knowledge base containing just the following: for all x, king x and greedy x implies evil x, king John, greedy John, brother Richard John. Okay, this is my knowledge base. Okay, so what I could potentially do is I need to, this and this and this is already sort of in relational, in propositional form. Okay, because the extra brackets can be, I can say king bracket, king parenthesis John can become king dash John. That's a proposition. Okay, so the real question is how to convert this, which is a quantified statement, into a propositional form. Okay, and all you need to do is for every possible x that, so x can take the values of constants in this domain, objects in this domain. And given this database, the only objects I have are John and Richard. Okay. So what I'll wind up doing is I will write for X once John and once Richard. And the conjunction I get essentially is what this universal quantification stands for. Okay. So I could write this as King John and greedy John implies evil John, King Richard and greedy Richard implies evil Richard, and then these other things are already in propositional form. Okay. So now, even though this looks as if it's not in propositional form, it's in relational form, it really is in propositional form. You know, because you can always make up a proposition called King dash John and greedy dash John, evil dash John. Okay. So I have a propositional database now. Okay. So the question then is, just a second. Question then is that since it's a propositional large base and I know how to do inference in propositional large bases using model theory. Right now I'm still thinking in terms of model theory. Okay. So I just do this huge truth table, and if I want to prove a theorem, I take the negation of it, add it to the database, and show that the truth value of negation of the theorem to be proved and the database will always be false. That's how we always looked at the entailment computation. Okay? Yes?
You don't, in this knowledge base, you don't know that Richard is greedy, right?
What?
You've got King Richard and...
Yeah, but all I am saying is, I can still say this. I don't know that Richard is greedy,
okay.
But this is nothing wrong. If Richard is a king and Richard is greedy, then Richard will be evil. There's nothing wrong with saying that. Yes. What? No, I don't. That's exactly the exact same question that you're asking, which is, I don't know whether Richard is a king. I am saying if Richard is a king and Richard is greedy, then I can say Richard is evil. Where? No, these are propositional symbols. Just because you have a propositional symbol, that doesn't mean that proposition. So first of all, in a propositional logic database, right, if I have, suppose I have a propositional logic database which has PQR as the propositions, and the database is not P and Q and R implies Q. This is the database. Is P true here? No, P is not true. Okay, if I want to, just because P is a proposition doesn't mean P is true here. I mean, if I want to say P is true, I have to write it as a sentence. Okay, so King Richard is just a proposition symbol which may or may not be true. Okay, so again, we just converted what we don't know, which is first order logic model theoretic entailment, into something that we know, which is propositional logic model theoretic entailment. Looks fine and dandy. Okay. The question, of course, is how do I exactly go about doing this in a general fashion? Okay. And that's this slide. And you understand this, you basically understand the basis of converting a first order logic database into a propositional logic database. Okay. So the basic idea that you did here is, notice that you first had to figure out what are the objects in this database. Okay. So objects in the database are John and Richard. Now, of course, in this particular case, there were no functions. If there are functions, then functions can be applied to objects to give new objects. So that can happen in the general case. Okay? So you have to figure out what the objects are. And so that basically is the universe of your database, the universe of objects in the database. Okay? First, you need to figure out, given a first-order logic database, what is the universe of possible objects? And given the universe of possible objects, you can then figure out the proposition symbols. The proposition symbols are essentially predicates in the database applied to all possible configurations of objects in the database. Okay? So you need a universe and you need a base. Base is the base proposition. Okay? And since a guy called Herbrand first talked about it, we call them Herbrand universe and Herbrand base. Okay, so here is an example that we look at. This is general enough to make all the points. So my example in this case is very similar to previous one, except I have a function, which makes things interesting. Okay, so I have for all xy, friend of xy implies likes xy, friend row pat, friend, pet, son of Rao. That's my first order knowledge base. Okay, given this, I need to talk about the Hadron universe. Hadron universe contains all the constants in the database, which is Pat and Rao, and all ground functional terms. All ground functional terms. Because those are all the new terms that you can make up. Okay, new objects you can make up. So, son of Rao, son of Pat, son of Rao, son of Pat, and all these things. Unfortunately, obviously, the moment you have one single functional term, function, you have infinite number of functional terms. Okay, but given these functional terms, you can talk about depth of a term. Depth of a term is the number of times a function has been used in deriving that term. Okay, so these Rao and Pat are depth zero terms. They're just constants. And son of Rao, son of Pat, depth one terms. Son of Rao and son of Pat are depth two terms. Keep that in mind. So there is some sort of a stratification of terms. Even though there are infinite number of terms, there are the zeroth depth terms, first depth terms, second depth terms, and so on. Okay, keep that in mind, depth of terms. So now that I have this universe, the base essentially is all atomic sentences. All atomic sentences I can make. An atomic sentence is nothing but a predicate symbol with terms in it. That's an atomic sentence. Okay? So all I need is, now what are the predicate symbols? In this database, the predicate symbols are two in number, friend and like. They're only two. Okay? Now why did I decide that these are predicate symbols? Because syntax tells me so. I mean, in fact, I could have declared it up front. But even if I didn't declare it, because I wrote it this way, this must be a predicate. Otherwise, this won't be a valid sentence. Okay? So now I have friend and likes are the predicate symbols. So I wind up writing in friend for x and y, take a term here, and put it in x and y from the universe. Okay? So friend Rao Pat, friend Pat Rao, friend Pat Pat, friend Rao Rao. That's just using only the depth zero terms. Now I can start using depth one as well as depth zero terms, which is like friend Rao, son of Rao, friend Rao, son of Pat, friend son of Pat, son of Rao. That's the depth, using the depth up to depth one terms. And then I can do this, depth up to depth two terms, up to depth three terms, etc. Now if I have a functional symbol, obviously, I essentially have infinite number of ground atoms. Okay, but it's worth noting the following thing. If there are n constants, forget me, for a minute assume there are no functional symbols. If there are n constants and p kre predicates, okay, then the size of Hadron universe is m, because they're only n constants. And the size of the Hadron base is p times n power k. Because, you know, you take a predicate, one of the p predicates, and it has k arguments. Each argument can be independently filled with any of the terms, any of the n terms. So n first, one second, n third, n fourth, n power k. P times n power k. Okay? So that's the sizes we are talking about. So you know actually what's the kind of blow up that occurs when you convert a first order logic database into a propositional database. What? K is the predicate. So the idea is what is the largest arity predicate? So if I have P of X, Y, Z, W is the this is a predicate, and this is Q of X and Y, this is a 2 array predicate, this is a 4 array predicate. Okay? The blow up, in fact, one of the interesting things you'll notice is when you convert first order logic database into propositional database, the arity of the predicates wind up dominating how much of a blow up you get. Okay? And as we are talking about this, there are several things to think about. One, of course, is we are actually looking at this just for theoretical perspective. Can we even have reasonable model theoretic semantics for first order logic? Okay? But on the other hand, there's also a practical aspect to it. If all you have is a propositional theorem prover, okay, and you want to act as if you are a first order logic person, you can always convert it to propositional logic database and do the theorem proving there. Okay, upfront it would look like it's a dumb thing, you know, why would you want to do that? And in fact, many practical systems these days actually wind up doing something like that. Why? Because it so happens that the propositional solvers are very efficient. Because propositional solvers are very efficient, where possible, you try to convert it into propositional database. And so when you are compiling, in fact, one of the issues that people talk about is try to write the original database in such a way that the arity of the predicates, the maximum arity of the predicates is reduced. See, you get to decide how to write your knowledge base, right? Okay, you can always make up dummy new predicate names which will always have at most two arity or three arity. Okay, there'll be more predicates, but there'll be fewer arguments per predicate. That's useful because k winds up being in the exponent. Yes, sir. Yeah, you can make up some crazy thing like position up. In fact, I mean, this is something that people do. We might look at it later on, but so what you can wind up doing essentially is, you know, if I have, let's say, P, X, Y, Z, W, etc., then I can always make a new predicate called P first. Okay, P. Okay, P, X, Y, Z, W, and then I have an actual fact called A, B, C, D. A, B, C, D are the constants. Okay, I can split this into P, I predicates. Okay, a P, I predicate is the ith argument of the predicate P. Okay, P, I 1, A, and P, I 2, B, and P, I 3, C, etc. So in essence, you encoded the same information, but in a weirder multiple predicate. Okay, the only reason this would make sense is because the arity winds up being an exponent. Again, this is something that if you ever actually see somebody converting their real first order logic database into a propositional database, you will see these kind of compilation tricks. This is a compilation trick. No, all you're doing here is the number of predicates has increased, but the number of predicates only is multiplicative. Okay? And the arity of the predicate comes up in the exponent. So this is a funny compilation trick. Now, in fact, if you write your knowledge base this way, people may not understand it well. Okay? So you can always do it during compilation. So you let people write these predicates, and then when you're compiling, you do this trick. Okay? Yes, sir.
Wouldn't it be better to make the number be like a subscript, like select different predicates instead of making an argument?
There are multiple ways of doing it. All I'm trying to say is, essentially, I'm going ahead and saying that there are compilation tricks. Right now, you are looking at it as if this is one of those theoretical arguments. In fact, for the next slide, we'll still be looking at it as if it's a theoretical argument, because after that, we'll do actually proof theoretic inference. What's weird is that currently as we speak, in fact, many first order logic, many scenarios where you need to do first order logic theorem proving without function symbols at any rate, they try to convert it into some sort of calls to propositional logic theorem provers because they are fast. And when they do that, they'll wind up doing these compilations. Okay? Now, of course, all of this goes out the window the moment you have one function symbol. The moment you have one function symbol, this n is not n, it's infinity. And so this is p times infinity power k. You're dead. Okay? Basically, you have to understand the Herbrand universe and Herbrand base, first of all. And the second issue that you need to understand is that the Herbrand universe is sort of stratified. There are different strata of terms, zeroth order terms, which is no functions, only constants, up to first order, basically where you have terms which have at most one function used in developing the term. Up to second order means you have terms which use up to two functions. Okay. Now, having done this, then comes this one slide, which essentially is the heart of why first-order logic theorem proving, you know, first-order logic model theory, model theoretic semantics are actually feasible. Okay, because without the infinity, you can understand. You're done. If you have no functions, first of all, if you in your language there are no functions, with this slide, you now know that you have converted a new problem into an old problem. So theoretically, you don't have to learn anything new. Agreed? Okay. So the issue then is what happened, and in fact, this also tells you that when people try to talk about first-order logic databases, if they don't actually use functions, in essence, their expressiveness is basically, it's a finitely more expressive. It's not infinitely more expressive. Okay? So if you want, you can always convert the predicate the first-order logic database without functions into an equivalent propositional logic database and do theorem proving there. Okay? It's feasible. Now, is it efficient or not is an interesting issue. What for the longest time people assumed it won't be efficient, and now they assume that it's quite efficient, but then now the tide is turning and people also realize that if you have relational structure and you compile it so that you lose all the relational structure so that they become propositions, certain things become actually harder in terms of time to prove. Okay, so however, at least you see that relational structure, just relations, is just syntactic sugar. Again, remember that word syntactic sugar. That means you can just get rid of it and, you know, convert it into. So it's like C language up to without functions. First order logic, analogy between first order logic and propositional logic is like C language or whatever higher level language and assembly language. Because the growth of the program is only finitely larger written in assembly language. Okay? Now, of course, we want to talk about functions too, because otherwise it's not full first order. Okay? And the way it works for full first order essentially is that Herbrand essentially pointed out that even if you have functions, if a theorem is actually entailed, if a theorem is provable, then there will always be a theory, a proof, which only includes a finite subset of the knowledge base. So think of this propositionalized knowledge base as zeroth order propositionalization, so which only uses terms up to zeroth order. Then 1 and 0, 2, 1 and 0, 3, 2, 1 and 0. So bigger and bigger databases. Think of this IDDFS idea, where you know the databases are becoming bigger and bigger. So what you could do to prove a theorem is start from n equal to 0 to infinity, generate a knowledge base by using only up to depth n terms. That will be a propositional knowledge base. Then do the, you know, model theoretic big table, okay, and show whether or not the theorem is proved. If the theorem is proved, you're done. If the theorem is not proved, you increase n to n plus 1 and do it again. Okay, the great theorem of Herbrand is that if the original theorem was actually provable, okay, then there exists a finite n where you would be able to prove it. If it was not provable, all bets are off. Yes?
So how do you know that the theorem is provable?
No, you don't know. You don't know.
No,
semi-decidability is one of these happy-go-lucky kind of theorems. You know, all it is if the theorem was originally provable, then you will be done in finite time. When you get a theorem, you don't know whether it's provable or not. So whether or not you like semi-decidability, semi-decidability is better than undecidability, but is it really practically better? And what are we talking about practicalities when we are talking about just decidability? All decidability means is before the universe ends, some finite time this thing can get done. We're not talking about polynomial, we're not talking about exponential, we're not talking about double exponential, we're not talking about multiple exponential. We're talking about just finite. Okay, so at that point of time, how do we know? So do we actually care the difference between semi-decidability and decidability in practice? Obviously, probably not. Okay, but theoretically, it's a good point. Okay, that if the theorem does have a solution, then you would find it. But by the way, think about this. This is not all that surprising. What was the A star search theorem? What is the A star search theorem? If there is a solution, you will find the optimal solution. I can always set up infinitely large search spaces which don't contain a solution, and A star search does not have to terminate. It's very easy. I mean, that's the nice thing about setting up problems. You can set up search spaces that are infinitely large. And when there are infinitely large search spaces, the only reasonable question to ask is, if there is a solution, by definition, if there is a solution, it's at a finite depth. Will my search algorithm find it? And similarly, if there is a finite proof for this theorem, will my theorem proving procedure find it? And this theory, I'm sorry, and this, where did we go? This basically says, yes, it is possible. Okay? And of course, then, so this is the proof saying that, in fact, first order logic theorems can be proved. If they're true, they can be proved by using Herbrand Bayes in model theoretic semantics. Remember, again, we're all talking about model theory still. We still didn't talk about proof theory. Okay? Now, so it is actually a complete inference. Because if the theorem is true, you can prove it this way. Okay. Now, of course, then Turing and Church essentially proved independently that this complexity of this is semi-decidable, which should not be all that surprising because, you know, of course, if you think this is about the only method of solving, you know, proving the theorems, then you shouldn't be surprised. You won't be surprised that when the theorem is actually true, you can be done in finite time. When the theorem is not true, you may never be done. Okay. Of course, these guys did it on for all possible ways of solving this problem. I mean, the complexity of problems don't depend upon the way you try to solve it. Right? For example, I can write a sorting algorithm that involves generate a permutation and check if it is a sorted order or not. That's a nice n factorial algorithm. And then I can say, looks like it's exponential. And I can improve it slightly better, okay? But that doesn't make it exponential, you know. To prove that it's exponential, you essentially are saying there is no way of finding a better algorithm. And that's more or less what they said. There is no way of finding a better algorithm than this in terms of complexity. Okay? So this is the sort of the apotheosis of a whole bunch of work that humankind has done with logic. Okay, starting with what, you know, 450 in this particular case, 450 BC, sorry, where did we go? 450 BC up until 1930. We got there now. Okay, now of course, I already mentioned to you that none of this doesn't affect much of what Gödel said, because the semi-decidability theorem is only true for first order logic, and Gödel's theorem is only true for first order logic augmented with mathematical induction, which is not a first order logic construct. Okay, and then at that point of time, even semi-decidability doesn't hold. Basically, the idea is there may be theorems that are actually provable, but you can't prove them. That's not a problem with first order logic. If a theorem is provable, you will prove it, which is nice. Okay, so Gödel basically says life is even more miserable because to do even simple math, you need to do you know, mathematical induction as part of the axiom set, and that will kill you. Okay, and of course, there's beautiful historical trivia about how, you know, the context under which Gödel's work came about, and how, for example, mathematicians were trying to just formalize math by saying, you know, all you need to do is write it all in first order logic, and then we have a complete theorem proving procedure. So essentially, you don't need to write new papers, you know, more or less, at least mathematically, everything that is true can be proved in a formal fashion. Okay, and so Principia Mathematica by Bertrand Russell and Gottlob Frege has done some work. Gottlob Frege is the saddest thing because he wrote this thick book and sent it to the printers. And then while it was in the printers, they found out about all these problems that, you know, in fact, Gödel's theorem as well as Bertrand Russell's set theory paradoxes all that fun stuff. Okay, but that's the connection that we'll make here. As far as we are concerned, we realize that if you increase the expressivity to higher order logics, you know, it's not even semi-decidable. Okay, so that's fine. Now we leave the good old world of, so notice that I did not write the actual the truth tables with the columns, because you know how to do it. Essentially what I did here with this slide is to convert first order logic theorem proving into propositional logic theorem proving, at least in a model theoretic sense, and so you can solve it now. Okay, this is a mathematics trick, right, so that you don't have to solve another problem again. Do you guys know about the mathematician and the fire in the bedroom? So there's this mathematician who is sleeping one day and he wakes up and finds that there's a fire, you know, because he left his cigarette or something and there was a fire. And so what he does is he wakes up and tries to put out the fire. There is a glass right next to him, but it was supposed to be full of water, it wasn't. So he walks down to the bathroom, fills it with water, comes in, pours it over the fire and stops the fire, goes to sleep. So 3 days later there's again a fire. Okay, he wakes up. This time he actually realizes there is a glass full of water. So he takes the glass, empties it onto the floor. Now he says this is reduced to a solved problem and goes back to sleep. Okay, so that's exactly what I did. I reduced first order logic theorem proving to a solved problem. It's not an efficient way of doing it necessarily. You know, just as a mathematician probably went and smoked, but he did know that he has solved this problem previously. Why waste time again solving it? That's exactly what we did here. Okay, so what we are doing now is the proof theory, because even in propositional logic, actually in propositional logic, you could do model theory or proof theory. Okay, but by the time you come to first order logic, there is no point in really kidding ourselves that practical systems would do model theoretic proofs. Okay, because they essentially, even a small database of this type, I mean, if you have a functional symbol, suddenly it blows up. Even if it does not have functional symbols, it's going to have propositions, Herbrand-based propositions of the order of p times n power k. Those are the number of propositions, so those are the number of rows in your, not number of rows, 2 power that is the number of rows in your truth table. Clearly you need a really large piece of paper to do the theorem proving this way. Okay, so we always go for the proof theoretic semantics and proof theoretic inference, and the idea there is come up with sound and hopefully complete inference procedures. And if you have a sound inference procedure, whatever it writes is a theorem. And if it's also complete, then and if it's a complete inference procedure, then every theorem that is true will be written by it. And if it's sound and complete, then you're happy. Okay, so much of what we will do in this part is essentially mirror the discussion that we did for propositional logic. Okay, we know, for example, from propositional logic that modus ponens is sound but not complete. Modus tollens is sound but not complete. Resolution, on the other hand, was complete. Okay, so what we will do essentially is do the same thing. We'll say here that in fact modus ponens and modus tollens and resolution are still complete, but the only issue is we only knew modus ponens and modus tollens for ground axioms, because only ground first order logic axioms correspond to propositional axioms. If you have a quantification, what do you do? Okay, so much of what we will do in on the way to proving the showing the obvious that we'll do resolution is to actually say how do we handle the variables in the inference. Okay, so here are the deals. Everything that is a sound inference rule for propositional logic is also a sound inference rule for first order logic, but there are more rules which are sound for first order logic. That's the way to think about it. Okay, so if all you have are ground sentences, okay, then you can just do modus ponens, modus tollens, even propositional resolution with them, and all of them are correct, all of them are sound. They won't prove every theorem, but whatever they prove are theorems. Okay, so for example, a ground inference procedure will allow us to say, if I have a sentence, you know, A and B are constants, so if I have a sentence saying P of AB implies Q of A, okay, and I know that P of AB is true, then I can write Q of A is true. The parentheses are really syntactic sugar, because the parentheses didn't change anything, because P of AB really is P dash A dash B implies Q dash A, P dash A dash B is true, so Q dash A true is true. That's all we did. Okay, and so you can do the same thing for modus tollens, etc. Okay, now yes. Yeah, so the entails, and so basically the difference between the symbols, in case I haven't made it very clear, is normally the convention is that this is the entails symbol, okay, and this is the derived symbol, okay, and these are not part of the logical syntax. You can't write a logic sentence which uses these symbols. These are extra logical. Okay? So you cannot have, in the database, you don't have these symbols. Whereas in the database, you have things like P implies Q. The implies sign normally is also written like that. Okay? Or you can do AND, you can do OR, you can do negation. These are extra logical symbols. Okay? That's the thing. So we are talking about, by this you are saying model theory can prove the theorem. And by this you are saying that a specific proof theoretic inference procedure derives the theorem. Okay? Now, when I say a proof theoretic inference procedure is sound, what I'm saying is everything this guy derives is actually entailed. And if it's complete, everything that is entailed is derived. That's the basic idea. Okay? So actually I should have, given all that, I should have written this as a derived symbol. I shouldn't have written as an entailed symbol. Modus ponens, basically, this should have been a single line, not double line. Okay? Because I'm talking about proof theory. Now, what about quantified sentences? Okay? The basic idea is that knowing that a quantification is either a big conjunction or a big disjunction, you can do certain obvious inferences. Okay? So for example, if I have a sentence F which is quantified for all X, okay, then this I can write, this is basically, this can be used to derive F with X substituted to any constant I want. For any constant. That's all I mean, right? Because this is true for all X's, so it's also true for a specific X. Okay? This is not all that hard. So this is basically called universal instantiation. So if you have for all X, king X, and greedy X implies evil X, then basically this is what we used actually earlier, okay? Then this particular thing can be used to derive this sentence. And also this sentence, I'm sorry. What did I do? And also this sentence. And also this sentence. All of these can be derived. Okay? Now, what's interesting is the following. Suppose I have for all X, P of X implies Q of X. Okay? And I happen to know P of Rao is true. I would like to be able to derive Q of Rao. There's a way of doing it. Right? What I'll do is I will start from here, and using universal instantiation, I will derive all the ground versions of this. Now, if I do it, basically one of the things I'll write is P of Rao implies Q of Rao, P of Mary implies Q of Mary, etc., etc., etc. You write a huge number of these because you don't know which one is actually useful. But from the theory point of view, there is at least one sentence that you will write here which can be combined with this, and modus ponens will allow me to derive Q of Rao. Okay? So this allows us to use quantified sentences and modus ponens by basically in a two-step process. You do first universal instantiation and then do modus ponens. Now, to make this practical, of course, what would be needed is to avoid generating all these other theorems, which are true but are not useful. Now, this is not a special problem now. Even in propositional logic theorem proving, you knew that the search in theorem proving essentially is to prove only the things that are needed to prove the main theorem. Because if you're out there trying to prove everything that is actually true, most of which are true but are not relevant. This was the classic what joke, the Sherlock Holmes Watson joke. Because Watson was out there deducing everything. But the most important theorem that he should have been able to prove is that, you know, their tent was swiped. Okay? So the point again is, efficiency-wise, there should be some way in which you can take a two-step process here and split into, make it into one step. Okay? And if you do that, so if you can actually do this in a one step, then that's called GMP, or generalized modus ponens. And the way the one step works is basically the following. It essentially tries to say that given this sentence and this sentence, okay, I will try to essentially, and I want to prove Q of Rao. Right? So what I need to do is see what should X be such that, for example, I can use this theorem, this particular sentence. If I set x equal to Rao, then this will be this. At which point then I have to basically prove P of Rao, which is already there. Okay, this process, which you take it for granted, this is basic simple matching. You know, because this guy is giving everything, Q-ness for all the x's, if you allow P-ness for the x. Okay, so you get P of Rao, since you want Q of Rao, you can, to get Q of Rao, you need to get P of Rao. And to do that, essentially, you first did this. This matching is called unification. This process of matching an expression with another expression such that they become syntactically equivalent is called unification. And of course, there are rules on this. You cannot map constants into other things. You can only map variables to other things. Variables can be mapped to other variables as well as terms. Okay? And we will talk in a minute about, you know, the details of the unification procedure. But the interesting thing is, once you figure those are details out, which are pretty simple, they're not like rocket science. Once you do the unification, you have a very powerful rule called generalized modus ponens. And the advantage of generalized modus ponens is it's doing modus ponens plus universal instantiation in one step without unnecessarily deriving a whole bunch of useless intermediate sentences. Okay? Yes? No, all I need to know is this. No, because this is for all. So in fact, the domain of X, so for all X essentially says, universal instantiation says that given this sentence, I can write any sentence with x substituted by a constant. So in essence, basically, what this means is this is a universal quantification, every x. Okay, if you want to say this only holds for some x's, you could do that. You basically did it in this case. Q of x holds only if P of x is true. If you want to say this entire theorem only holds if x is a number, then you write for all x, number x, and P of x implies Q of x. Okay? But we'll talk about the unification in a minute, but keep that in mind because it's a very useful thing to do so that you can do generalized modus ponens. Now, why is generalized modus ponens important? Is generalized modus ponens sound? Yeah, because it's essentially doing a chain of sound inferences. So it must be sound. Is it complete? No. Because modus ponens is not complete, so generalized modus ponens is not complete either. Okay. But unlike simple modus ponens in propositional logic, on which we didn't make a spend a huge amount of time, generalized modus ponens in first order logic is actually quite a useful inference. Even though it's not complete, it can be used to do a lot of things. A case in point, prologue basically uses generalized modus ponens plus cut operator. Okay? So you know now that all prologue is doing is using generalized modus ponens. Now, of course, when you have a modus ponens inference, you can use it in the forward direction or the backward direction. Prolog uses normally it in the backward direction. Okay? And so, and then the other reason to pay attention is the next project after the Bayes net would be a prolog interpreter that you will write for yourself. So you will actually code all this stuff. Okay. So that's kind of interesting. Generalized modus ponens is a very useful rule of inference. Now, what about, so we, before we talk about unification, when I have universal quantification, I can do universal instantiation. What can I do if I have existential quantification? What is the simple rule of inference that makes sense for existential quantification? What's interesting is there is basically this existential instantiation inference rule, which says, if it is true that there exists V for all, so if I, my sentence says there exists V such that alpha is true, then I can pick a specific value for V. The requirement is that the value I pick should not be in the database. The value I pick should not be in the database. It should be a brand new function or a brand new term that's not within the terms of the database. And I can say that I can substitute that particular k for v and write alpha. Okay, so in particular, suppose I have there exists x, happy x is my sentence. And this sentence appears in a database of the following statements, for all x, happy x implies things x, okay, and things Tom cries John, etc. This is my database. So I can, in this database, use existential instantiation on this symbol to say I can make X to be anything I want as long as it's not a thing in the database. Okay? Now, it cannot be John, it cannot be Tom, because they're in the databases, in the database as a constant. So I can just make up, normal usual idea is to make up a nonsensical name. Okay? In particular, in a minute we'll talk about why, we will make up a constant starting with SK, okay, for something called scolem. Okay, so I can make SK 0. It's a constant that's not in the database. Okay, so I can just write, this allows me to derive happy SK 0. Somebody is happy. All this guy is doing is give a name to that guy. But when you're giving a name to that guy, it better not be one of the people that you already know. Okay, that's what is your existential instantiation does. And of course, we will look at existential instantiation only later when we actually do resolution theorem proving. Because the interesting thing about this inference is that it allows you to prove theorems which only have existential proofs. Okay, now what is an existential proof? I'll show you in a minute. Actually, let me show it to you because something interesting should be done in the middle of the class. Something else that came in, that's fine. So because SK0 may well become John and Tom, but you can't say that now. That's the point, okay? So the reason, actually, so this allows you to basically do, once you have existential instantiation, and you do resolution theorem proving essentially uses everything, existential instantiation as well as universal instantiation, and you can then do prove theorems with only existential proofs. Okay, what is an existential proof? A classic case is this: are there irrational numbers p and q such that p power q is irrational, p power q is rational? You know, this is background, the old stuff. You know, p and q must be rational numbers such that p power q is rational. And I'm asking this question. Okay, so can I prove this theorem? Here is my proof. Consider root 2 power root 2. If root 2 power root 2 is rational, it has to be either rational or irrational. Agreed? If it is rational, then I'm done, because p is root 2, q is root 2. Okay? If it is not rational, it must be irrational. If it is irrational, then consider root 2 power root 2 power root 2, which is root 2 power 2, which is rational. Right? So then p is root 2 power root 2 and q is root 2. Prove. I'm done. Have I told you a number p and a number q such that p power q, two irrational numbers p and q such that p power q is rational? No. Did I prove that they will exist? Yes. Okay? And in fact, it turns out this theorem can be proved constructively too. Okay? But what's interesting here is this is a classic theorem from like elementary number theory which has an existential proof. This is mathematically valid proof. You cannot do these kinds of proofs if all you have is generalized mod exponents. And you can do these kinds of proofs if you have essentially, if you can deal with existential quantification and columnization. Okay? Yes, sir. No. I did not say what are p and q here. This is my entire. No, so I didn't understand. So on this side, right?
Yeah.
So p, I'm calling p this and q this,
yeah.
And since root 2 power root 2 is already irrational, and this is anyway irrational, I'm assuming everybody knows that root 2 is irrational. So I have two irrational numbers p power q such that it's a rational number. It's a cute proof, by the way. I mean, this is a beautiful way of saying proving things without giving anything to anybody. Okay? What's beautiful about this is, I'll send you a long article later on. For a while in mathematics, people hated existential proofs. All the proofs that you did in CS355 are constructive proofs. To show that something will have a certain property, you will provide a construction to make that automaton which has that property. Here is a proof which says that's possible without telling you even a single instance. Okay? And what's interesting is, in mathematics for a while, people, mathematicians fought with each other and said, if you have a proof like that, it's no proof at all. And so it was close to having anything which depended only on existential proof was not going to be mathematics. So it will all be written out of mathematics. And there was a big controversy at one point of time, and then slowly people came to senses and said, this is as good a proof as any. Okay, and so the mathematics that you know and love depends on both existential and constructive proofs, and it's nice to know that first order logic theorem proving can do existential proofs, and in fact it does it because of the case analysis. Did you see the case analysis? Where does case analysis come from? Disjunction. What is existential quantification? Disjunction. Okay?
Why is
because, let's see, what are we talking about now? Because root, this thing is nothing but root 2 times root 2. This is elementary exponentiation ideas. So if you have p power q power r, it's nothing but p power q times r. Isn't that nice that computer science people forget this stuff? Right. I'm sorry to say this. I mean, I don't mean anything bad about you. I know this because I help my son, who is in 6th standard. So I am okay. You know, so you find some people in 6th standard and tutor them, and you'll remember this stuff too. Yes, sir.
I think what you're confused about, what you're
confusing
me is that it needs
credit.
Yeah. Something
different. No. Why is this? The p power q, no, if you write p times p power q power r, the convention of that. Oh, okay, you're right. Yeah. Yes, yes, yes. Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, the reason, yes, right. But the point is, I want this. I'm getting this from here. So I'm taking that in parentheses and doing square root. You're right. Okay. But interesting point here is that it's an existential proof, and resolution theorem proving can do this kind of proofs. Not that it does a fat lot of good, because resolution theorem proving still won't do much of mathematical proofs, because most mathematical proofs require mathematical induction at least thrown in. And Gödel already proved not everything can be proved. Okay, but if you can do this with resolution theorem proving. Okay. So some technical points actually worth remembering is the following. Actually, this is only useful for people theoretically inclined. If everything that when you do universal instantiation rule, then the resulting knowledge base is equivalent to the original knowledge base, in the sense that in essence everything that's true in one is true in the other and vice versa. When you do existential instantiation and throw in a sentence like happy SK0 into the knowledge base, okay, the new knowledge base is not actually equivalent. However, it has the useful property that it will only be satisfiable when the original knowledge base is satisfiable. And so you can use this to prove theorems. Okay, that's all I will say about it for now. So once I have, but then what we really like is, as I said, the ability to combine universal instantiation rule of this type. So basically I want to be able to say, this is a universal instantiation rule, and if I have this sentence as well as P of AB, I should be able to directly prove Q of A. And that's what generalized mod exponents does. That requires unification. And I'll talk about how to do unification now. Okay, not particularly hard to do, but the point that you want to understand in unification is essentially you are stopping the universal instantiation from proving a whole bunch of theorems that are all right but are not useful for what you want to prove. So make it only prove the things that you want it to prove. That's basically what you're trying to do. And so for example, again, this slide is saying the same thing again, as I said earlier, which is, if you say for all x, king of x and greedy x implies evil x and king John, right? And then for all y, greedy of y is true and brother Richard John, okay? Given all this, what can you prove? Can you prove, for example, that John is evil? Yes, you can prove that John is evil. But if you do it actually by universal instantiation, then you will generate King Richard and Greedy Richard implies Evil Richard, King John and Evil John imply, Greedy John implies Evil John. And then of course for Greedy here, you know, Greedy Richard as well as Greedy John. If you write all of them, then you can just do the ground versions, two mod exponents. Just one mod exponent. Because there will be Greedy Richard, Greedy John coming from here, King John coming from here, and there's going to be a mod exponent saying King John and Greedy John implies Evil John, and so you would get this.
So that same R says for every Y, Greedy Y, does that mean everyone that you put in that?
Yeah, for everybody. According, this basically believes that everybody is greedy.
Oh, okay.
That's what it believes. That's what it says. Okay? So now the point of course is, all I want to prove is evilness of John, I shouldn't have to generate all these other sentences. And this can be a real problem if in fact it's a large database with large number of constants, and if you're unlucky, at least a couple of, or even one function symbol, in which case you're dead and gone. Right? And so you want to be able to prove the theorem in sort of basically by only deriving the things that are needed to prove the theorem. And that requires unification, okay? And all I'm going to talk about is this mapping procedure. I already said that in doing this unification, all you are essentially doing is constructing a constructing a match or a unifier, okay? And a unifier is, you know, normally you write the unifier sigma or theta is of the form for a variable x is mapped on a term 1, is mapped on term 1, and variable y is mapped on to term 2, and so on. Okay, these can be any terms. Okay? Now, of course, one thing is you cannot map a term to another term. That's not allowed. Only variables can be mapped onto anything. That makes sense, because you can't say, to prove this theorem, I'll just assume Rav is John. That's not allowed. To prove this theorem, I can assume X is John. That's allowed. Okay? And one other issue, of course, so for example, I can say X is mapped onto father of Y. I can do that. That's fine. That's a reasonable substitution. I can also map X, of course, to father of Tom. Yeah, exactly. You can only map. A mapping basically associates a variable name with a term. Term can be variables as well as constants as well as function of terms. No, that's not allowed. That's not a unification. That's all my point is. Okay? So a unifier basically computes these kind of things. Now one question of course is, am I allowed to do this? X is mapped onto father of X. Seems okay, because father of X is a term. X is a variable. But that's a special case. We don't allow that. Because if you do that, then where do you stop? Right? X is mapped onto father of X. That little x can be mapped onto father of x again, which can again be mapped onto father of x, so it's infinite regress. Okay? So you say that the mapping should have the property that a variable is mapped onto a term which does not contain that variable. Okay? And that, if you can do that, that such a mapping is, and then the point of doing this mapping is to make two expressions syntactically equal, then it's called a unifier. Okay, so let's think about the following thing. I have P of X and I have P of Y. Okay, I want to make them equal. Okay, here is a mapping. X to Rav, Y to Rav. Is that a unifier? Yes. Okay? Here is another mapping. X to Y. Is that a mapping? Yes. Which is a better mapping? Which is a more general mapping? This one. Why? Because after you do this mapping, if you then do the mapping, so here X becomes Y. So everything in this will, these two will become P of Y, P of Y. Now if I map Y to Rav, then I get the effect of doing this originally. Okay, so I would talk about something called MGU, maximal general unifier. A maximal general unifier is a unifier such that this will not happen. That means you cannot find one more unifier, one more mapping. So this one is not maximal general unifier, because I can get another unifier, compose it with a third unifier to get this one. If you can't do this, then it's a maximally general unifier. Okay? And what you're trying to compute in doing unification is to do maximal general unification, because you don't want to commit to deriving a sentence unless you know what that sentence should be. Okay? Which one is, I mean, you see, so this is a unifier. This is a unifier too. This is not a maximally general unifier, because I can take this unifier, compose it with this matching to get this. Okay? And the other interesting thing I did here is the composition operation. Matchings can be composed. You can do one matching, one mapping, and then do one more mapping. And doing this mapping followed by this mapping is the same as doing this mapping. Agreed? Okay.
So if you had x is equal to rho, y is equal to Tom, would that be an MGU?
Would it be a unifier at all? It's not even a unifier. Because if x equal to rho and y equal to Tom, then this will become P of rho, and this will become P of Tom, and they are not syntactically equal.
Okay.
See, it's a mapping, but it's not a unifier. A unifier makes the two things unify, become same. Okay? And a maximally general unifier basically does that while making the least amount of commitment as to the actual values of x and y. That's basically the point. Okay? So now let's look at some examples. Knows John X, knows John Jane. Can you do unification of them? Yes. Okay? And in fact, I'll tell you like a simple idea, which is if you are writing a unification program, which in fact, unfortunately, I give it to you for the project, but you may as well know how it works. First check the lengths of the terms. If their lengths are wrong, it can be unified. Then check the predicate symbols. If the predicate symbols are wrong, it can't be unified also. But actually, in fact, what you can do is you just check the length of the term first. If the lengths of both of them are the same, then they can potentially be unified. Then you see if the first of these, car of these, if you're writing it list, you can write this as list begin knows John X, and this as list begin knows John J. Okay? And then I take the car of both the lists and see if they are unifiable. Okay, if they are unifiable, then you take the mapping for that unifier and propagate it to the rest of them, and then try to see if I can recursively map the rest of the expression. Okay, so in this case, I will take knows and knows, and I'll ask, can they be unified? Yes. What's the mapping? Null. Because they're already equal. So then I basically substitute null mapping into John X and John Jane. They will still be John X and John Jane. Then I pick the first of the rest, John, it's equal, and again the mapping is null. And then, so now I have left with X and Jane. Now I try to map X and Jane, unify X and Jane. This is the first time I actually do something useful. X and John are not equal, but they can be made equal because X is a variable and Jane is a constant. And so I have a mapping called map X to Jane. And that is the mapping that comes out of the entire thing, saying as that's the unifier. So in this particular case, the unifier is X map to Jane. Okay? And then similarly, knows John X, knows Y OJ. This is more interesting. Let's do this. So knows and knows already done. Now you try to map John and Y. You want to try to unify it. You can unify it if you don't mind setting Y to John. If you set Y to John, and you have to substitute in the rest. Okay? Y to John, and you substitute in the rest, it still remains X and OJ. This is not actually interesting yet. And then to make them unify, you would get the mapping X to OJ. Now I have to compose this mapping with this mapping. If I compose in this case, Y is John, X is OJ, so that's all I get. X is OJ, Y is John. Okay? Let's look at the last one, this one. John knows Y, mother of Y. So in this case, again, I come up to John and Y, okay? And then so if I do Y equal to John, I get these parts equal. Now, actually, the first time I have to push that mapping through to the rest of it, right? So now you have X here. X doesn't get changed by mapping Y to John, but mother of Y gets changed to mother of John. Now I see, can I unify them? The answer is yes. And if I do X equal to mother of John, then I'm done. Okay, and then just a second, and then at this point I compose, and the full unifier is Y is John and X is mother of John. This is the process. Okay, how about this? John X and knows X OJ. Does that work? Why? Because first you would do X is John, and then, so now John should be equal to OJ. You don't get to do that because none of them are variables. So this cannot be unified. That's all basically. Yes, sir.
But maybe some of the techniques are useful in CSP are useful for unification.
Yes, in fact, yes. Okay, but now you understood what is happening in the unification. Okay, so anyway, those are all the answers. And so GMP essentially is the following thing. Generalized modus ponens, the inference is the following thing. If I have a rule saying P1 and P2, etc., PN implies Q, which is a formula. Q is basically a predicate of arguments. Okay, and P1, P2, etc. also are predicates of arguments. And I also know P1 dash, P2 dash, etc., PN dash are true. And if there is a mapping theta, okay, such that applying the mapping theta to P1, P2, PN will make it equal to this, then I get to just write Q of theta. Okay, so for example, if I have King John and Greedy, I'm sorry, if I have King John, let me see what I did here. So suppose I have for all x, P of x, and for all x, y, P of x and Q of y implies R of xy. Okay? And if I have P of Tom and Q of Mary, okay, and P also of John, and I want to, basically what I'm saying is P of Tom and Q of Mary will become equal to this if X is Tom and Y is Mary. In which case, I do the same substitution here, I get to write R of Tom, Mary into my database. That's the generalized modus ponens. It looks kind of, we're making a huge deal about something very simple, which is basically you're throwing mapping into the inference procedure. Okay, but so let me actually show you an example, and that would be the last thing we'll do today, of actually using this to prove something non-trivial, okay, like the way Prolog does, and this is an example that your project should be able to do, okay. We'll do it again next time in case there are questions. So here is a bunch of knowledge. Apartment pet is a pet that is small, dog is a pet, cat is a pet, elephant is a pet, dogs and cats and skunks are small, Fido is a dog, Louie is a skunk, Garfield is a cat, Clyde is an elephant. My question is there an apartment pet? Right? That's my question. Okay? So here are all the sentences. And I did not notice that when I'm doing generalized modus ponens, I only assume that the quantified sentences are all universally quantified because there are no existential quantification allowed. Since every sentence is only universally quantified, I can then ignore the universal quantification, not write it. So if there is an X, if it's a variable, it's universally quantified. So here are a bunch of sentences. Small x and pet x implies apartment pet x, dog x is a pet, cat is a pet, elephant is a pet, skunk is small, cat is small, dog is small, Fido is a dog, Louie is a skunk, Garfield is a cat, Clyde is an elephant. And my question is there, now here's the interesting thing, in the Prolog, the entire data, this is Prolog by the way, for those of you who remember, this is basically like Prolog. Entire database is universally quantified. Typically the queries are existentially quantified queries. Is there an X such that the query is true? So my question is there an apartment pet? Okay, that's the proof sheet. And you know, I'll quickly go through it now, but then you look at it and we'll again look at it next time in case there's questions. So Prolog does generalized mode exponents in the backward direction. It tries to prove by going backward, starting from what it needs to prove and see if all the sub-goals are provable. So what I did here is I tried to check whether apartment pet X is true, and I said, well, I can prove that if I can prove that something is small and something is a pet. Something is small as well as something is a pet. Okay? Both. So that's why there's this and thing here. Okay? Now to prove something is small, I just picked skunk as a small thing. Okay? Now when I proved that skunk is a small thing, so I picked, because skunks are small, so I can prove smallness by proving skunkness. Now I need to prove a skunk is there. Now it turns out there is a skunk, right? Louis is a skunk. So with Louis as X double dash, this side is proved. So now this is the interesting part. Since I proved this sub-goal with X dash ultimately equal to Louis, I have to prove this sub-goal also with X dash equal to Louis. So now I have to prove that Louis can be a pet. To prove that Louis is a pet, I basically try to prove the petness of Louis using this rule. For that, Louis should be a dog. Poor guy is not a dog. Then I try to prove it using this rule. He's not a cat either. Then I try to, I don't know why I wrote this, elephants apparently can be good pets. So I'm actually anti-skunk apparently, but other than that, everybody is a pet. So I try to prove Louis is an elephant. Louis is not an elephant either. So what do you do in this case? You have no proof. So now you have to backtrack. You say, I can't prove. In fact, in a way, you're backtracking here too. You tried to prove dogness, then you went up and looked for catness, then you went up and looked for elephantness. If none of them worked, you said, I cannot prove pet Louis, so tell me who asked me to deal with Louis. And these guys wake up and say, oh, sorry, we left you with that. Then you say, do something else. So don't get me Louis. So in fact, what Solar does is, maybe look for some other skunk, which could be a good thing. And then that would try, and when that fails, then it will say, look for something else that is small. And, you know, hopefully one of these days it will get to cat, and then cat would be an answer.
How is it selecting which rules to look at?
Like, no, it, what Prolog does is depth first, top down, left right. That's what Prolog does. So it picked dog because as it is going down this, the first rule which said I can prove petness is the dog rule. So it tried that. Then it tried the cat rule because that's the second. Then it tried the elephant rule, that's the third. And notice that the reason it tried skunkness to prove smallness is because I wrote this first.
Okay, so say rule two were more complicated and had dog of X or, you know, the sky is gray then pet or something like that, then it would do depth first and then try to prove that the sky is gray and then, okay.
All the things you know and love about depth first are true here. Depth first, it can go into la la land. Okay, so I can say, for example, you know, to prove pet X, I can say you have petness, then you have a pet, and you get petness if you are a pet. So then petness implies pet, and pet implies petness. If I write those two rules right here, Prolog goes into la la land. It tries to prove petness using pet, and pet using petness, and so on and so forth. Okay. And you have to stop that infinite regress. That's why normal Prolog, the language, has a cut operator. Okay? But when you do this, essentially you put a depth limit at best. That's the only thing. Okay? We'll stop here. We'll look at this again after you had a chance to look at this, because this is also going to be your last the next project. And then we will talk a little about the resolution theorem proving and then get out of first order logic next time. I have the exams if you want to pick them up.